The Basics of Genetics, Lecture 7. Environment over the Long Term. The Genetics of Populations.
In this lecture, we're continuing with the topic of environment, but this time I want to stretch out the time period that we are considering. So this is a long-term discussion on environment. And sometimes this falls under the rubric in genetics of the genetics of populations or population genetics. And here's how you might encounter it at first. At this point, you are, I hope, very intrigued with dog coat colors, perhaps looking around for evidence of Mendelian ratios. I will also add, perhaps not always finding anything that you would interpret as a Mendelian ratio in nature, for all kinds of various reasons that we've got into. And I've made some specific suggestions about what to look for, but here's what you might have noticed. Instead of Mendelian ratios, let's move on from that. What you are seeing is variability. You're seeing amazing variability, and you're seeing it even in organisms that you don't typically think of as variable. Let's get away from the dogs for a little bit. I mean, the dogs are such a stunning example of variability that they tend to cloud over everything else. Let's look at more subtle things. I'll tell you what one of my favorite examples is. When I drive to work in the summertime, I drive past a pond that is full of beautiful water lilies in blossom. And even at the speed that I'm driving by and surreptitiously peeking out the window quickly and keeping my eyes on the road, I notice there are pink water lilies and white water lilies. And I will tell you that I have also tried to quickly estimate, is that a 3-to-1 ratio that I see there? Am I seeing 3 pinks to every 1 white? Doing this very quickly, of course. I don't think so. And I think I probably should not be looking for a 3-to-1 ratio of pink to white. Instead, I should be enjoying that there are pink and white water lilies, two different versions of the pigment gene for those water lilies, right there in the same environment. Here's another example that I really love. Next time you're in a situation where you can really examine some white clover, perhaps in an old lawn or some other place where white clover is growing, take a good look at the leaves and be amazed at how many different subtle types of leaf markings there are. White against green. All sorts of little chevron shapes and V shapes and W shapes and M shapes. Take a good look at white clover at some point and be absolutely amazed at how in the same lawn you can have so many different clover leaf phenotypes. Now, are you going to be able to pull a ratio out of all that? No, I don't think so. And actually, there turns out to be some good reasons for that. What I really want as a take-home story for this lecture is out in the environment where you're actually looking at organisms, the really simple Mendelian ratios probably are not going to pop up. Other more interesting things will occur, though. By the way, if being out in nature for you means being in the grocery store, that's fine. There's plenty you can do there, too. Think of all the varieties of tomatoes, the varieties of colors of those, the varieties that we have nowadays of potatoes, including purple ones and white ones. So you can catch a little glimpse of what one particular group of vegetables in the grocery store looks like when you stop and think of variability and variety. Although I will warn you against multicolored Swiss chard. I deliberately looked into that for you for these lectures, thinking, oh, great, here's our example, Swiss chard. In the very same bunch of Swiss chard, we can have reds and yellows and greens, and it's just an absolutely beautiful bunch of colorful plants. It turns out that they mix seeds deliberately in order to get those mixed colors, and they set that up for us so that it looks pretty in the grocery store. So actually, Swiss chard is not a good example. But plenty of other things are. Here's what I want to suggest to you, that you go out of your way, choose a particular type of plant, choose a particular type of vegetable if you like, but wildflowers are a great example, and look for what sometimes get called flower color polymorphisms. I actually go to my Peterson's Field Guide to Wildflowers and look for that phrase and look for variations, pink versus white, purple versus white. By the way, here's a little hint. It turns out that this works best for the pinks, purples, and whites. For various reasons, it's not quite as straightforward for the yellow and orange pigment pathways in flowers. Now, why might none of this end up looking like a Mendelian ratio, like a 3-to-1 ratio? Well, because the environment exerts a selection for particular alleles, particular versions of genes. Let's look at the purples and pinks and whites of flowers, for example. One particular study that really intrigued me was that the more brightly colored a flower in this purple to pink range, the more drought resistant it is, for various reasons that actually we don't have time to get into. But the idea that they actually sampled lots and lots of colors of a particular wildflower, they knew that there was this natural variability and they associated it with more resistance to drought. And that's the sort of thing that happens in the environment. We immediately have major environmental interactions such that some genes work better than others in a particular environment. Here's another example that you should watch for. We have a number of different species of ladybugs or ladybird beetles. Those are the colloquial names for those in North America. But we also have introduced species of ladybugs and ladybird beetles. These are in some cases introduced from Asia. They were originally introduced for pest control because they can be set loose in gardens and they will go to work and eat some of the more harmful insects. One of the consequences is that we have quite a few introduced Asiatic beetles with different sorts of hibernating behaviors, and one type especially likes to hibernate indoors. So if you are living somewhere in North America and have an infestation of certain ladybugs or ladybird beetles into your house in the fall, it might well be this introduced species of Asian ladybugs called Harmonia axyridis. And that spelling will be in the course booklet. But let me describe the beautiful variations in these. They can be a bit of a nuisance in the house. They're not harmful, but a bit of a nuisance. But while you're clearing them out, you just want to take notice of this. Some of them have tiny spots. Some of them have enormous spots. Some of them have black on orange spots. Some of them have orange on black spots. Some are completely black. Some are almost completely orange. The variability is just astonishing. It's a wonderful example of variability within a species. Now, what's going on with so much variability in one group of ladybugs when some of the more native species seem to be variable only around a small set point? I mean, they might have a little variation in spots or a little bit of variation in respect to the size of those spots, possibly because this is an introduced group of beetles that does not have any natural predators yet. And so it's a good example of what happens to the genetics of a population when that occurs. Variability can run a little more freely, and there's not as much of a selection for a particular spotting color. It's, by the way, also what has happened with dog genetics, of course. I mean, humans have just let dog genetics have completely free run for all the possibilities for the pigment pathway. But that seems to be what's going on with these particular beetles as well. In contrast, if you made a little collection of native ladybird beetles or ladybugs, you would still see some variability, but it would be around a much tighter set of variables. While I'm on the topic of color, let me introduce a little bit of the color genetics of two other groups of organisms that are highly visible and therefore accessible to you if you'd like to examine natural variability. One is the color of birds, and many people have access to a bird feeder and therefore get to observe birds close up all the time. And it would be just really fun, wouldn't it, to know something about the genetics of those bird feather colors. So I'm going to tell you about that. And the other is fish, because again, those are amazingly accessible organisms, whether you're interacting with fish in the wild or whether you're simply making a visit to the pet store and standing in front of the huge bank of all the different aquaria loaded with the huge variety of fish that pet stores typically have. They also have wonderful varieties of birds. So you've got a field trip right there, and I thought you might enjoy hearing about the genetics of bird and fish colors so that you can add a little something to your observations of those next time you get a chance. This is going to turn out to be a complicated set of pathways interacting and conspiring together to give you the overall color of whatever the organism is. Let's start with birds, but this is also going to apply to fish. So you can imagine the most complicated color patterns of your favorite bird, and this is going to apply. First of all, there are going to be blacks and browns. That will be a melanin pathway, not unlike what we've just been talking about. It's not necessarily identical. The birds have been evolving separately from the mammals for quite a while, but there are going to be a lot of similarities to how birds get blacks and browns, the melanin pigments, into their feathers. So if you can understand what we just did with mammals, you've got sort of a handle on the level of complexity for birds. But that's not all for birds. We've got oranges, yellows, and reds. And what's really interesting about those is the separate pathway, highly dependent on the environment, because those yellows, oranges, and reds are coming from carotenoid pigments from the diet of the bird. Now, they might not necessarily come directly to the bird. There is an indirect way for them to arrive. The carotenoid pigments are made by plants. But there are plenty of birds that don't eat plants. The vast majority of birds don't eat a lot of plant material. There's a great deal of eating of insects and other things like that. So what we're seeing here is these carotenoid pigments get passed from plants to whichever insect ate those plants, to whichever insect eats that insect, perhaps then to whatever bird eats that insect. Or these carotenoid pigments from plants are packaged up in seeds. And in some cases, birds are eating seeds directly. But the interesting thing is the pathway that the bird is maintaining is as complicated as the melanin pathway, but the starting material is coming from the diet of the bird. And you can see this firsthand with some birds kept in captivity in zoos that are supposed to be brilliantly colored pink or bright orange. And if they don't have quite the right diet with enough carotenoids, they may start to lose some of their coloration. Same is true for pet birds. And in fact, sometimes there are supplemental diets for pet birds that are supposed to help to maintain the oranges and pinks and yellows that you expect in those particular birds. So think cardinal, if you like, or think canary, or think flamingo. But then there are all the wonderful blues and silvers and even iridescent colors of birds. And that's a separate pathway. And maybe the most interesting of all, those are not actually pigments. Those are structures in the feathers on a very, very fine scale. If you put the feathers under the microscope, you will not actually see these structures. They're a much finer scale than what can be visualized with a regular microscope. But very fine structures on the feathers that are reflecting certain wavelengths of light back to our eyes. So blue in a bird is blue light being reflected from the structures and the feathers back to our eyes. Silvers, we're getting sort of a mixture of pale pigments or pale wavelengths of light being reflected back to our eyes. And iridescent, which comes from Iris, goddess of the rainbow, is all kinds of rainbow colors coming from complicated structures in the feathers and reflecting back different colors depending on what angle we hold the feather at. You know, if you hold an iridescent feather and turn it, you'll see slightly different colors being flashed back at you. Now, how can you tell whether you've got a structural pigment in a feather versus a real pigment like melanin or carotenoid? Well, if you are out in the woods collecting bird feathers that have dropped and happen to pick up a blue feather, you can do this. You can bring it home and you can put a little dab of cooking oil on the feather, and that will fill in the little spaces between the structures that are bouncing the light back to your eyes, and you will immediately take away the blue color of the pigment. Whereas if you had a little orange or yellow feather and dabbed on a little bit of cooking oil, it would not change the color at all because that's a real pigment. So a structural pigment will be essentially shut down if you fill in the spaces with some sort of liquid like cooking oil. It's the same for fish. It happens to be a very similar system for fish. So everything that I've just told you about bird pigments, which you can use for looking at wild birds or birds in captivity. Same for fish. We have blacks and browns. Those are melanins. We have the oranges, yellows, and reds. Those are carotenoids from the diet, different pathway. And we definitely have beautiful silvery and iridescent fish and sometimes brilliant blue fish. And those are structural pigments, such that if you had an individual scale from a fish that was bluish or silverish or iridescent, you would not see any sort of blue or silver or iridescent color. The color completely disappears because it's sort of a figment of the way our eyes work and the way these structures work. Let's say that you're watching birds at your bird feeder and looking at birds that are black and brown, birds that are red like cardinals or yellow like or orange like orioles, or yellow like goldfinches, or blues like blue jays, perhaps even some flashes of iridescent color in some birds. What are you to make of all of that, besides having some kind of feeling for the complexity of the underlying genetics? Here's what I understand from some birding and ornithologist friends of mine, that the sturdiest feathers, the feathers that are sturdiest to do what birds need to do with feathers for the most part, and that is to fly, are the black and brown feathers. So the easiest explanation for why there are so many black and brown birds might be that, well, if those are functional feathers, those are the strongest feathers. The black and brown melanin pigments make those especially strong feathers for that particular use. And that would be the end of the story, except we know that we have birds that are entirely red, birds that are entirely blue, birds that have just absolute rainbows of iridescent colors. And I think this is a good example of the dynamics of what really happens in environments with any genetic trait, including color. That is, you've got a balance between the necessities of having strong feathers and then for the oranges and the blues and the silvers, something called sexual selection. That is, there are many, many birds, the males for which are the ones with the amazing colors, the colors that are anything but black or brown. It's the red male cardinal versus the duller colored female cardinal. It's the male peacock with its wonderful iridescent feathers versus the peahen. And so you've got another whole set of selection factors from the environment, in this case, the environment being the female bird who is choosing who she is going to mate with and apparently choosing the more brightly colored males, whether it's carotenoids from the diet or whether it's structural pigments. So bird colors are wonderfully complicated and well worth analyzing, but there's always a story with exactly what's going on. Is it camouflage? Is it strength? Or is it something like sexual selection by the female for the male? While you're examining animals and plants in your environment, let me suggest something that you might want to try at home concerning plant pigments and one of their interesting nuances. Recall that when we were talking about the cookie factory, I introduced you to the word modifier gene. I said these are genes that produce products that make slight differences in pathways. We talked about chocolate chips, no chocolate chips, frosting, no frosting. And in the dogs, we talked about those diluter D genes that gave us milky or smoky colors of melanin. Here's a wonderful example of a modifier gene that you can do experiments with from your studies in nature or even your studies at the grocery store. And let's do this from the grocery store because that's accessible to everybody. The colors of most of the purple-colored vegetables that you can find at the grocery store, purples and reds. By the way, not the color of tomatoes. That's different. But I'm thinking of cabbages, are from a pigment group called the anthocyanins. And they come in blues, they come in reds, they come in purple, and then they come in lack of pigment, which would be white. So we have cabbages that lack those pigments. Those are the greenish cabbages. You're seeing the background color. The greenish color is the background. Or you're seeing beautiful reds and blues of red cabbages. Take some red cabbage, bring it home, and boil it until you get some red-colored liquid. And you will have a little solution of that anthocyanin pigment. And by the way, you can eat the cabbage if you want to. You're essentially preparing the cabbage for dinner. But save some of that liquid And now you can play around with it, with things from your very own kitchen, and realize that what you're doing is you're manipulating this pigment in the same way that many plants manipulate this pigment to give variations around the colors red, blue, and purple. Take the most acidic solution you can manage from your kitchen, and that will be white vinegar, which you can dilute a little bit with water so it's not quite so concentrated. That would be your acidic solution, a little bit of white vinegar. And then take your most basic or alkaline solution that you can manage in your kitchen, and that will be a solution of baking soda in water. And in that case, I like to put in enough baking soda that we end up with a little bit of baking soda at the bottom of the glass that I'm mixing it in, so that we have quite a saturated amount of baking soda in there. And that's your most alkaline solution. Now, take your red cabbage water and set it out in 6 clear glasses across the table. Put a little bit in each glass, maybe fill each glass half full, and then put a small amount of your most acidic solution into the first glass and watch the color change. It should turn to a beautiful pink color. And then put a little bit more into the next glass and a little bit more into the next glass, and then try the same thing with your alkaline solution, that's your baking soda solution, with the other 3 glasses, and look at the beautiful greens and blues that you get from that. Now, what are we really doing? Well, we're mimicking what happens on the cellular level and why the blues and pinks and reds of plant colors are actually so interesting. We're mimicking what modifier genes would be doing. That is, slightly changing the acidity and alkalinity of whatever pigment is present. In this case, it's the anthocyanins. The other interesting thing, though, is depending on what plant it is, that acidity or alkalinity can come from outside of the plant. And blue hydrangeas are a great case in point. That is, depending on the acidity or the alkalinity of the soil, the anthocyanins that are giving the beautiful colors of blue hydrangeas can actually change the tone of that pigment. You can have pinkish ones, you can have purplish ones, and you can have nice clear blue ones. So there's an example of a wonderful mixture of environmental effects and genetic effects on a fairly profound level. That is the color that you're going to get from particular plants. And something that needs to be taken into consideration if you're going to try to understand the overall picture of why things are pigmented the way they are. Now, I'd like to talk next about this whole topic as part of population genetics, as part of this bigger field. And I'd like to introduce Charles Darwin at this point, because this is the genetics that Charles Darwin wishes he had understood. He apparently came very close to understanding at least what Mendel was saying. And here's how we know this. First of all, we know that Darwin was extremely interested in the breeding of plants and animals. And in fact, one of his books is called The Variation of Animals and Plants Under Domestication from 1868. And we know that the kind of breeding selection that goes on when you create animals and plants, particular breeds of animals and plants, that's what gave him the idea for natural selection. He was thinking about what happens when animals and plants are domesticated. So he was definitely thinking along these lines. What he didn't realize was what the underlying mechanisms could be. Darwin even was a breeder of plants. He was breeding snapdragons, and people apparently can go back to his original notebooks on that and see that some of his snapdragon experiments produced 3-to-1 ratios of color combinations, but were not recognized by Darwin as being 3-to-1 ratios. Because remember, if you're really doing this with actual plants, you're not going to get a clear 3-to-1 ratio. You're going to have to try to interpret that, and Darwin did not do this. Now, it turns out that Gregor Mendel, in his monastery in Moravia, read Darwin's Origin of the Species. How do we know that? Because we find it in Mendel's library. So Mendel was familiar with his contemporary Darwin, who was far away in England. The two never met, of course, and definitely read Origin of Species. And there are some assumptions by historians of science that it was an influence on him, that he enjoyed the book and he learned a great deal from it. Meanwhile, we have access to Charles Darwin's library. Charles Darwin owned in his library a copy of Mendel's work, which was published in a larger tome that included a number of different studies. But here's how we know that even though Darwin owned the book, he never read anything of Mendel's study. The pages were uncut. And that's what people used to have to do in those days, especially with a relatively inexpensive publication. They would have to take a special knife and cut each page away from the other pages, oftentimes as they read. And so one of the fun things you can do is actually find out whether a particular book in someone's library was in fact read. So Darwin was very, very close to having read Mendel, and it might have made a difference in the way he wrote things up, because what he was really missing in his Origin of Species is the genetic mechanism by which the genes that he suspected were operating were indeed operating. Now, this is also population genetics, the genetics that your doctor is interested in, more and more interested in. You might have noticed this the last time you were at the doctor's office, that your doctor might have asked you some questions about your ethnic origins that went a little beyond what some of the typical check boxes have been in recent years for questionnaires. In other words, sometimes you'll get a questionnaire that will ask you to identify yourself as white or African American or Hispanic or Asian, and they'll give you four little check boxes. And, well, what are you? Which box are you going to check off? It seems a little oversimplified. But one of the things that's happening more and more in doctor's offices is that they actually want a little more nuanced explanation of who you are. And one of the reasons for that is population genetics and the growing realization that it has going to have a very profound effect on how we handle medicine in the future. So to set us up for this, let's talk about the origins of humans starting about 200,000 years ago. And let's go through the sequences that we suspect happened when humans began to migrate throughout Africa, Europe, Asia, Australia, the Americas, all the way up to the 20th century, and maybe put into context why suddenly doctors are more and more interested in where your particular human ancestors ended up and spent much of their time for thousands of years. So we start 200,000 years ago with Homo sapiens, that's our genus and species, living in East Africa. Evidence for that is considerable. We have DNA evidence. We have all sorts of archaeological evidence. 200,000 years ago, we all start off in East Africa. About 80,000 years ago, humans began migrating throughout Africa. And I want to start with that because that's important. Africa is a huge continent, and you get all the different variations on Africans through these migrations throughout Africa. So that's as important as the migrations that headed out in other directions. And we also had humans beginning to migrate out, especially 40 to 50,000 years ago, to Europe and Asia, and eventually out to the South Sea Islands and Australia, which must have been some amazing feat. How much is that in terms of generations? Well, it's about 2,000 generations ago, 40 to 50,000 years ago, about 2,000 generations ago, that we were all African. So essentially, on the grand scale of things, we're still all African. There's just been some migrations, and we're a little bit more spread out over the globe, and there have been some acquisitions of some particular mutations. 15,000 years ago, humans migrated to the Americas. That's only about 1,000 generations ago. And, of course, less than 1,000 years ago, the whole thing was brought full circle, Europeans coming to the Americas. Finally, the globe is surrounded, and humans are in pretty much every habitat they can be. 20th century humans have begun to become highly mobile. That is, those that can afford it, those that are not in small villages in countries where people are less mobile. But we have spent many, many, many more generations with our ancestors not being mobile at all. There have been little pockets and islands and valleys of groups, small villages, that have been more or less inbred And I'm not using inbred in a negative way here. Inbred in really a genetic sense, these small groups have, for the most part, been interbreeding groups. And that has made a huge difference to what sorts of diseases and medical conditions you might be especially susceptible to given your particular ancestry. So the latest thing now in doctor's offices is that your doctor would like to know what they're starting to call your geographic ancestry, which is a little more complicated than simply asking someone's race, which is actually not a real relevant term here. Geographic ancestry. Now, can pigments go along with this? Sure. People who have a geographic ancestry along the equator of the Earth, whether it's the Asian tropics or the African tropics or the South American tropics, are going to have darker pigments. There are all kinds of good reasons for that. People with paler pigments are going to tend to be from the poles, are going to have their ancestry from the poles. There are going to be exceptions to this, but the question of where are you from and not simply checking off little boxes according to skin color is really the latest thing for personalizing medicine and watching out for particular predispositions that people might have for diseases. Now, I have some really nice examples here, including a book that I think I would like to recommend to you. And that is the book called The Island of the Colorblind by Oliver Sacks. It'll be recommended in the readings at the end of this chapter. This is an extreme example, but sometimes it's the extreme example that will help us to understand the more subtle examples. He examines people living on a Pacific island and on a Scandinavian island. Both these populations are similar in that both had some sort of a genetic mutation in their pathway that allows them to perceive color. So that's a complicated pathway. And as a result, there's a predominance of an extreme kind of color blindness on both of these islands, the little Scandinavian island and the little Pacific island. The significance of their being islands is that for many, many generations, these people were isolated and really were inbred. And this was a particular condition to these islands. It's a wonderful opportunity, therefore, to study the pathway by which we perceive color, as well as to understand all sorts of things that developed in the cultures of these islands around their having this extreme form of color blindness. One of the things is this particular version of color blindness makes these people extremely sensitive to light in general. So a great deal of their culture takes place indoors or at dawn and dusk or at night, but the brilliant sunshine of the day really hurts their eyes. And so their whole culture has a tradition of being in more shadowy twilight kinds of situations. And Oliver Sacks, of course, writes about this brilliantly. So I recommend it, The Island of the Colorblind. And it's a little glimpse about what personalized medicine is going to be like. If you were from one of these islands, your doctor would be extremely interested because it might mean that your family was predisposed to this kind of color blindness. Now, here's an example of another sort of island that's of great interest to geneticists. Think of the Amish communities in, for example, the Pennsylvania area, but also throughout the United States and throughout the world, wherever there are Amish people. They are not literally living on islands, but they've created islands through their culture. They've created little islands, little pockets of what early village Germanic life might have been like, horses and buggies, no extensive use of electricity, different sort of schooling, even different dialects, certainly a different religion. It was, of course, religion that brought them together to begin with to make these little communities. But by creating these communities, they've also created an island-like existence with inbreeding. And again, I'm not using it in a real negative sense here. It's just the way it is. But they, too, have acquired their own sets of particular muscular, neurological, and metabolic genetic diseases that out in the general population would be relatively rare, but among the Amish are surprisingly prevalent, perhaps not so surprising given their island-like existence. Here's another example. Iceland, a large place, but island-like nonetheless, and somewhat isolated. Certainly it had connections with Denmark and has plenty of connections today, but is a place where there's a fair amount of genetic homogeneity. That is, there are generations of Icelanders who really have not left Iceland and have not had much interactions with people from away from Iceland. And for that reason, there was a great idea a number of years ago, great and controversial, of creating a national genetic database of the DNA of Icelanders for the purpose of really getting a nuanced understanding of what sort of particular predispositions there might be for diseases. And of course, Iceland would have its own list of predispositions as well. More and more, doctors would like you not to just check off four boxes, but to actually give a description as best you can, that you have a grandmother from Ireland, that you have some Native American from your grandfather's side, that you're a little bit French, and that maybe there's some Asian. They want the entire description because it actually could have relevance to understanding what your particular version of some cancer might be or your particular version of some other particular illness. Now, it gets intriguing when you start to talk about some genetic differences that are not clear-cut diseases or are not necessarily negative, especially within the community that we're talking about. And I alluded to that a little bit with Island of the Colorblind. The cultures that have arisen around that kind of colorblindness, as described by Oliver Sacks, have a real richness to them. There's certain artwork that gets done, and there are certain, you know, customs around being colorblind in this particular way. So that brings to mind deaf communities and communities of little people. Both of those are clearly genetic differences in much more complicated pathways, certainly the pathway that gives hearing people their hearing and gives people their regular stature as humans. When you've got little people, when you've got deaf people, you've got some sort of a genetic difference here. And there's perhaps a lot to be said for communities of deaf people intermarrying, all being able to sign, all having the same culture around signing, and little people also intermarrying and also having a community around being of extremely short stature. So it gets wonderfully complex. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily say there should be a community of a special sort of cancer necessarily in intermarrying around that. But certainly with some of the things that are around deafness and being of short stature, there may well be reasons to create almost island-like communities. So this lecture has just been the beginnings of population genetics. It's a big topic unto itself. It's a very exciting topic. I'm eager to know more and more about how it's going to be used in medicine and how it's going to help to personalize medicine. But it's time in this course to turn to the molecule that we have been not speaking of for the last several lectures, but the molecule that's actually causing all of this to happen, the root cause of everything that we've been talking about, and that is DNA. So the next lecture, I'm going to introduce you to replication of DNA and how DNA gets mutated and some of the other wonderful complexities of this molecule that is really the fundamentals of all of this. Genetics got along perfectly well through most of the 20th century without much of an understanding of DNA at all. But once we understood it, things were revolutionized. So it's time now in the next lecture to talk about DNA.
This ends Lecture 7.